and welcome to episode 38 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Kitty.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Spencer, spelled with a C, by the way.
Today we'll be talking about trick-taking games, from the classics like Spades and Hearts to newer trick-taking games like Moons and Nyet. But first, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, Shane Poole, George, and our newest friend of the show, Adam Harrison. Also a big thank you to Terrence Miltner for becoming a patron, and Alex Brown for increasing his Patreon level.
Yeah, thank you very much. So if you want more on Patreon, you can go to our website, tabletopgametalk.com. You know, when I say that fast, you can't hear that.
I don't think you even said it right.
tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon.
That was good.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
In case you haven't noticed, if you're new to the show, Spencer is a special guest.
I am.
If you're not new to the show, Josh had out-of-town plans that we had to work around, but this is actually okay because we're talking trick-taking games today, and Spencer is really enjoys trick-taking games. Yeah, it's his jam. So this is going to work out really well. We're just going to jump right into announcements. The announcements are no new contest yet. I'm working on something really cool, really big. I want to do bigger, more interesting stuff. So stay tuned. We have something cool for you, I promise. And again, congratulations to Alexandra Ambrose from last week's Santorini contest that she won there. And she'll be getting that game in the next few days, hopefully. And Kickstarter, a whole bunch of Kickstarter stuff today. 2 or 3 weeks ago, I ended up not doing any Kickstarter stuff, and then now
you're making up for it.
I am making up for it.
Lost time.
That's true.
Were you getting the shakes?
A little bit. Yeah. I was like, oh man, this could be cool. That could be cool. And one of our new listeners, Terrence, he is feeding the beast. He's made me aware of a couple games that I need to kickstart. And this one literally just came in like 20 minutes ago.
He's got a problem. You're taking advantage of the man.
I think Terrence, he put me on taking a look at the Galaxy of Train New Order Kickstarter. Now, this one I think Kitty's going to like, potentially.
Oh.
So this Galaxy of Train.
Is that how it's pronounced? It's Train? Looking at it, I think it would be Trian.
Trian?
Because Train, like, is it like a locomotive that goes across the galaxy?
I'm going to say Trian's probably more sci-fi. Let's go with that.
All right.
Galaxy of Trian.
We're probably both wrong.
Spencer's already being useful.
It's like 50-50 whether it's a mispronunciation or a typo with Chris.
Yeah, it could be. I literally copied and pasted.
All right, it's a mispronunciation. Right.
Galaxy of Trian, T-R-I-A-N. This is what looks to be like a space Carcassonne.
Ooh.
So instead of square tiles, it's triangle tiles because triangles are more sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. Nothing has corners.
Space is
space.
Made of triangles.
It is all triangles.
I think I read that in a physics book.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. You have to go to the newer physics books.
Yeah.
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 Older, they didn't.
They haven't
been
written yet, actually. Yeah, no. You have to imagine what future science is going to be like.
Yeah.
And then you can just make it be whatever you want. And for me, that's triangles.
Yeah. So, and Trian, maybe that's where the Trian comes from. Triangles. All right, Spencer, you're adding a lot. But the point I'm trying to say...
Stop trying to science, Chris. It doesn't work.
Terrence just sent me an email. He's like, is it too late for a Tabletop Game Talk plug? And it's funny because he's not associated with these games at all, but he, like me, likes to surf the Kickstarter. Ray Guns and Rocket Ships.
Surfing the Kickstarter.
Surfing the Kickstarter. Apparently,
we're
it closes.
Not old or out of touch at all.
You know, apparently, it closes Tuesday. So, this is the day that this drops. And he eventually says it's a dual scale, is fascinating. It starts as ships to ship combat, with crew placement having an impact on ships' performance. And from what he's seen, there are boarding parties as well. Looks so good. So, I have not looked at this one yet.
It sounds cool.
Yeah. I will likely look at this right after we record because it does sound cool. And I like the idea of ship-to-ship combat with crew members that run around. So both of those were kind of tips from Terrence. Another one that I backed was Trade Wars Homeworld Exteria Edition. This is another science fiction game.
Even Exterra.
Exterra. Wow. I want to roll here.
Chris has a cold this week. We'll cut him a break.
That's fair. That's nice.
We'll roll that.
So this is another one that I looked at. This is a unique deck building game for 1 to 4 adventurers. in the, let's see, lead one of the last Terran factions in the galaxy and defend your homeworld. I like defending homeworlds and I like space. So I'm going to back three space games this week, and you guys are just going to have to deal with
it. No one's surprised at all. No. You love space games.
I
love
off my space back. Games. And, you know, these actually sounds like games I might enjoy. So that'd be cool if you get some and, you know, I like to play them. So.
Yep. I'm also upgrading to get the extra components because that's what I do. Last week we were talking about all the different upgrades. I think the Galaxy of Trion, I'm going to say it that way, they have metal coins you can get. So it's, I think it's 60 metal coins for a $25 add-on. Mm. And if you backed it in the first 2 days, you got them for free. So I did that. And then I added another set on because they're kind of just generic gold spacey coins that
you know
I can
you can get metal coins at the bank for a penny a piece.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah
sometimes we're less than a penny a piece depending on what currency you're getting.
Oh yeah,
that's true. These ones are more spacey though.
That's cool.
I like it. Heroes of Land, Air, and Sea. Now this is a relaunch. This is done by the same group that does all of the Tiny Epic games, and this is not a Tiny Epic game. This is a grand 4X big box board game with 3D miniatures, and when they first came out, there was a lot of confusion, different levels. Is there minis? Is there standees? Different ways of doing the expansions, different add-ins, and it got really, really confusing, so he's just like, nope, I'm canceling the whole thing. There's too many questions. We'll launch it again when we're ready. So about 2 months later, a few days ago, he launches it again. And he's like, there's one pledge level. Actually, there's two pledge levels, but you can go in, you pledge, you get everything. And then he has some pretty cool stretch goals and stuff. So definitely check this one out, Heroes of Land, Air, and Sea. And you might be hearing more about this one in the coming future because this is going to be a hot one. And
so these are all war games thus far.
Yeah, for the most part. I would say all of these are kind of like these.
You feeling aggressive grand, or something? Or you're just like, you really want to take over the galaxy, so you find, are you just going with the flow, right? Just, it's what Kickstarter is handing you.
I was just surfing the Kickstarter.
All right, just surfing the Kickstarter. Just surfing the Kickstarter, bro. Yeah,
hashtag surfing the Kickstarter. And then the last one, I backed this today, and this is The White Box, a game design workshop in a box. This is not a game. It is a box of game components and then a manual of like how to design board games. It's only like $30. The interesting thing about this is it has almost 2,000 backers right now. There's about a week left on the Kickstarter, but about 2,000 people are buying this just to learn how to design board games. Hmm. And I think this is more an interesting thing on just where the industry is and how many people are like into designing and creating new games. But I'm interested in this one. This one goes through the Game Crafter, as well as you can get a $5 gift certificate to the Game Crafter when you back this up. And this week, I don't know if it'll drop this coming Friday or the following, but this week I do plan on talking to the founder of the Game Crafter on a side chat episode to just, you know, talk about what it is to create these print-on-demand games and how you can go about doing that. So if creating board games, or you have a prototype you want to create or something like that, check out that side chat. There's one prototype. It's not related to any of the three or four games I've already talked about. It's a different game that I actually had designed for an iPhone app at one point. I'm like, oh, I think this could convert to a good board game that I'm going to actually talk to him about on that episode. So I'll leave you all in suspense as to what that is.
I have to know.
No, you have to wait. And you have to listen.
I hate waiting.
Yeah, it's all right. You'll be fine.
Okay.
All right. So we're coming up on convention season.
Yep. I still don't have confirmation from Origins. I'm going to call them this week just to get confirmation. Mm. I did get confirmation from Gen Con, though. I think it's a Friday at 6 o'clock slot. I'll get you all the information, like the official information. But if you're at Gen Con, let me know, and if keep your Friday at 6 o'clock open, and we're going to do a live recording there. Who's going to be there is still up in the air. We know Josh is not going to be there.
I'm a maybe.
Kitty's a maybe. We're going to try to change that maybe, and so I need everyone's help. Everyone emails like it wouldn't be Tabletop Game Talk without Kitty. Kitty, you have to go to Gen Con. So I need, this is a campaign. Just saying.
Thanks.
Yes.
There wasn't enough pressure on this already.
Nope. You're going to make this happen. And then we mentioned GameholeCon, which we'll mention more about as we get closer to that date, which is the first weekend in November for GameholeCon. All right. That's it for announcements.
So let's get to some feedback about past episodes. If you have feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com or go to our Board Game Geek forums, easily found at tabletopgametalk.com/BGG, and become part of the conversation.
Yep. And we love when you do.
We do.
I don't know that this episode is just not popular, but there weren't a lot of feedback on trick-taking games on Board Game Geek, which is okay. You guys don't have to participate in every conversation, but we're going to make it entertaining for you nonetheless, if we haven't already.
I think it's just because they haven't discovered how awesome these games are yet, and you, Chris, are going to turn it all around.
No. It's on you. You are our special trick-taking guest to turn
Aaron's
it all around.
You're the expert here today.
But we are getting ahead of ourselves.
All right, so let's go to Aaron's email.
Yeah, so Aaron emailed us last week, and this he emailed us about doing a game on the podcast, and he did agree with us that he's like, well, maybe you're not really set up to do this game. I think I put a lot of pressure on him. I was like, you're going to have to send this. And he's like, I don't want that pressure. He didn't actually say it that way. I'm paraphrasing. But what he did say is a possible topic for you guys. When listening to a couple of previous episodes, I think I'm all caught up now, I've noticed that the term random you guys seem to be quite different from my idea of what random is. I think it was Chris, that's me, who said that chess has no randomness at all in the game. But to me, that's not really true. Everything that a player can see is open information, which is true, but what your opponent does is quite random, unless you're playing both sides or the opponent plays perfectly.
I think it's a good point.
So, well, I think our definition of randomness is actual, you are rolling a die. There is something outside of the control of the player.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. true that what another player might do seems random to you, but there is strategy to it. There can be, they're working on a long-term plan that you might not see, but is there. Whereas a spinner, a dice roll, a card draw, there is an actual random event happening there.
Yeah, I would agree. A player choice, although it can appear random, especially depending on the players you're playing with, isn't, because it's fully in control of that player. So randomness, when we use the term randomness, is exactly what Kitty said. It's undeterministic by the players.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, random to me means it's unpredictable.
Right.
Right. And so it's true that if you're playing against an opponent and you're not really able to predict what your opponent is going to do, which I think is even more true if your opponent is either particularly skilled or particularly unskilled. Right. Sometimes someone who's a real novice of the game is going to do stuff you're completely surprised by. Either way, that's random from your perspective. But it's not. It's still determined by somebody, whereas right. the die is really outside of that. But, your opponent is sort of like a die that you're up against.
Yeah. Right? Well, maybe think of it this way. If it's random to everybody involved, mm-hmm. it's random.
Yeah.
If any one person has control over it, it becomes not random anymore.
It can still be unpredictable.
Right.
But it's not random. Random is a specific term. If you're thinking of, computer random.
Yeah. Which, depending on the, but that's going too deep.
Yeah,
sorry.
But you are right. You're right. Yeah. So if anybody has control over it, we don't consider that random as we talk about random.
I don't know. So, okay, how about this? So let's say you and I are playing a game of chess, right? Mm-hmm. And, we can't really predict each other's moves. We're kind of on the same page and we're accounting for what the other one might do or something. And then Kitty walks up and she knocks over the chessboard. That was random.
That was random.
But it was something she completely intended to do. Right? So yeah, she wasn't a player. It still had some intention.
It's not an official move, though.
Sure.
I'm just making a case here. what is and isn't random. So yeah, that's outside of the bounds of the game. Right.
Yeah.
But I think just in general, in terms of what we're thinking about in life, random isn't necessarily that which a person is not intentionally doing. I think it's something that is unpredictable and unforeseeable to all of the direct actors involved.
Agree.
We're all lost.
But I agree with that.
In chess, the ability of the opponent to make a truly outrageous move that you can't, there is a bit of randomness there, a bit of chaos that can be injected into the game. It's true that still, if I do the weird move, that wasn't,
right.
But random.
That person still gets to make that choice.
Yeah.
That's the key.
I'm just saying this guy's got a point.
All right. Deal.
Going forward, though, our definition of random is dice roll spinner, card draw, something that is not affected by a player choice.
Yes.
Unless I'm talking, in which case I'm in your corner, Aaron.
Spencer would be considered random.
but I'm acting with intention.
Random intention. Let's go to the next one.
John sent us an email that says, "Hey, Chris, Kitty, and Josh. Just wanted to send a quick message saying how much I enjoy the podcast. I recently started gaming as a hobby and was looking for a podcast to listen to. I found yours in the new and noteworthy section of iTunes." We're so excited.
I know. I did not realize we ever made it to the new and noteworthy.
We didn't even see it.
Yeah.
"And have not been disappointed. I haven't quite caught up to the present yet. I'm on episode 29, but I can't wait to listen to the rest and be in the present."
Hello, past John. Welcome to the future.
"I also wanted to get your opinion on good games for travel other than a deck of cards. Are there any fun games that you have found that would be good for pulling out in airports, convention center lobbies, etc., that you would recommend? I work with a lot of youth at our church, and we travel to youth conferences, mission trips, etc. It would be good to have some games we might be able to take on these trips."
So I want to answer this question, and I want to dedicate an entire show to it, because this is like the third or fourth time that this topic's been brought up. So we are going to make this next week's topic. Yeah, we're coming on summer vacation. There's a lot of travel. People in the back seats of cars. They still do that, right?
People ride in the back seats of cars. Saying, yes, Chris. Out of touch are you?
I'm just thinking when I think family vacations, I'm like National Lampoon's Family Vacation. Yeah. There's still road trips and cars.
Families still travel in automobiles to places. Yes.
Just checking. Just making sure.
Technology. Things just change so fast.
It's amazing. But yeah, we want to cover like not only things that are good for traveling, you know, cars, restaurants, that kind of things, but how to travel with the games that you want, like the bigger games as well. What's a good way to pack those up and, you know, port them from one place to another?
Right, because there's lots of fiddly bits and it could weigh a lot and there's a lot of bulk to it.
Yep.
You got to have some strategy involved.
Yeah. So next week, we're going to talk all about it. If you have any feedback on this, go to our Board Game Geek forums and give us some input on that. But yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. I have a few ideas, but I need more. So we will cover that all in 7 days.
Hear that, John Lewis? You're directing the podcast.
This is what happens. It's like, you talk to us, we'll
this is your show, we'll talk ladies back. And gentlemen.
All right, so let's go to a question from one of our listeners. This is a question that won't fill an entire show topic, but we think is interesting nonetheless. And today's question comes from Aaron. So he says, "How do you feel about games that are too close to ripoff of existing games? Last night I played a game of Villagers of Valeria, and all I could think of was it was just Lords of Waterdeep."
So do you guys have some ideas on this one?
I've never heard of either of those games. Yeah.
But. Well, just any game, say... just so I can be the first person to bring it up, because say there's a game that's like a complete ripoff of Yahtzee, but they call it something different.
I've played a lot of games like that.
Okay. How do you feel about those games?
Well, Yahtzee's great, so those are fun too. Okay. No, I don't know. I think you lose some points for originality, right? If a game is just a ripoff of another game. But sometimes putting just a slight tweak on the rules and putting a very original sort of skin on the game, to me, can contribute quite a lot. Because we've talked about this in the past, that the aesthetics of the game, the way that things are named, the narrative that it's built around,
right,
can have a big impact on it. So I think if you take an existing rule structure, you see something, you go, you know, this could really have some appeal if it was presented in a different way, tweak the rules a little bit. Like, yeah, I mean, you didn't create something entirely new, but
if
I mean,
it's different enough to make it worth playing.
Yeah, I mean, you see this in like, you know, high art and in culture a lot of times too. People take stuff and they spin it. Is that not original?
Yeah.
Does it really matter? If it's fun, what does it matter? Who cares?
I think that sometimes these people make these games, at least this is my impression, because they've played that game, they love that game, but there's this one thing that has been bothering them forever. So they want to make their game that fixes that thing that bothers them. And that might not be different enough for you, but I mean, sometimes I feel like people are designing games so they can play them themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
And if it's worth it for them, then yeah. I mean... But be careful, do your research, because if you are bothered by that, You know, you don't want to end up and like owning three versions of the same game to you.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And a lot of times the what we refer to like the too close ripoff mm-hmm. type of games may actually be subpar. You know, it may not be as good. Maybe the quality is not as good. Maybe it's been rushed out. Maybe they're just really they're trying to make a clone of a game.
Of course.
And, yeah. you know, ride on the coattails of those things. I feel that these allowing these things to happen, though, is vitally important.
That's true.
So there was a lawsuit a couple years ago about a game. I believe it was King of Tokyo. There was a game in probably China that did the exact same rules, exact same everything of King of Tokyo, and just released it with a different name and different art. And again, I think it was King of Tokyo. I'm using that as an example from this point on, so don't hold me to this. But in any case, the
maybe
course
it was like
decided,
Emperor of Nagasaki. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. The course decided that you can't copyright a rule system. Like you can copyright the art, you can copyright the actual text, mm-hmm. but the rule system itself is not something you can copyright or patent for the most part. And this is one of the most important things that has ever happened in this industry. Had that ruling gone the other way, the industry would become stagnant.
Yeah.
Because
have
now
we talked about this before?
We have. We mentioned it just briefly on this. This goes to, so I'm in the software industry, and the software patents are supposed to foster creativity. Here, I just created this. I want to profit from it, and therefore it encourages me to create something. But software patents are different than like physical patents. It's here's this idea that I don't even have to implement, but now I can patent it. And what that does is it prevents other people from being able to use that idea moving forward. The board game industry dodged that bullet, and now we can have iterations over iterations over iterations. People can build on things. Be respectful. I mean, I think if you're a game designer and you're like, oh, I really like Moons, which is a game we'll be talking about a little later, I'm just going to completely retheme it, use the exact same rule system, and just give it a different name. That's not okay. And the fan base will essentially rebel against that. They're like, no.
Yeah. So I'm in software as well. And I'll say, at least for our listeners out here, what Chris was just saying about the effects of patents and copyright in software, that's not really just his opinion. That's like universally what everybody thinks. They could just be really stifling. It's bad for creativity and progress. Yeah. I think when it comes to board games and this idea of the rip-offs and sort of hat tipping to people who are your influences, I'm reminded of comedy. Stand-up comics is an area where your material, your originality is almost all that you have, and there's no legal protection at all. And if you've ever heard any stories from old school comics in particular, I mean, people would get, I mean, really like assaulted for stealing each other's jokes, or at a minimum blacklisted from clubs and things like that. It's something that the industry can kind of police on their own.
Yes.
And the wisdom of the crowd kind of works it out. So yeah. I think if you're a publisher and you're publishing a lot of blatant ripoff games that aren't adding things, I think the rest of the industry is going to start looking at you.
Don't be surprised if the industry rises up and says, no, we're not going to buy those. And
right.
I think that's completely appropriate. I just don't want to stifle the creativity of future designers who are trying to riff off of something they enjoy and do what Kitty says, which is kind of add their element or remove something they don't like or change something they don't like.
Because I think the only real risk of a harm there is if the ripoff game steals a lot of market share from the person who came up with this great game. I don't really see that happening. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but...
Yeah, usually the game's out for a year or so before a ripoff game can come out anyway.
Yeah.
And you're already below the curve of where that game sales.
Right, so it's really not doing any harm.
Yeah.
I feel like I brought this up last time. Recipes are the same way.
Yep.
That you can't copyright a list of ingredients.
Yeah.
So
yep.
It's the same, so, you know.
It is a great...
Keeping originality.
Yeah. It is a great question, though. And I think it's one of those things where it's worth going out there and saying this game is like that. Now, be careful with that. I've seen a lot of accusations that isn't this game just like this game? Oftentimes, if you look closer, there is a lot of differences to that. And when we start talking about trick-taking games, we're going to see a lot of similarities between these games. But they really are very different games, and they feel very different.
And those similarities are why you can call them all trick-taking games.
Right.
Right? So it's that there's a family of game or some sort of commonality doesn't mean it's necessarily a ripoff. It's that it's like, you know, it's a cousin. It's a relative.
Yeah. Now, that said, Aaron, I actually want to go take a look at Villages of Valeria now and see how close it is to Waterdeep, because I really like Waterdeep. And... if it's the same thing, I'm like, huh, all right.
We'll be awaiting your judgment, Chris.
Yes. All right. Well, let's go on to some other topic, shall we?
In this episode, we're talking about trick-taking games. They aren't the most popular kinds of games among board gamers, and we want to talk about why that might be. With Spencer's help being a huge Spades fan, let's see if we can find out what makes trick-taking games tick.
Yep. So I think that let's first define what a trick-taking game is. I don't know that it's required, but I think if you're an avid board gamer, it's entirely possible you've heard the term or just haven't played it. But essentially what a trick-taking game is, you normally have a number of suits. Normally one of those suits is going to be a trump or a lead or something along those lines. Everyone is going to play a card into the middle, and whoever has the highest of that lead suit or the highest trump will take that trick. At the end of a round, whoever has the most tricks wins that round. Oftentimes, these are played in teams, but not always. Oftentimes, it's required to have, you know, four players or something like that, like a set number of players, but not always. But really, the idea is I can take cards and I take sets of cards and I may or may not win. And the scoring can vary wildly from game to game. So let's start classic. Let's start Spades. Spencer, you love Spades.
I love Spades.
Why? And actually, how does Spades play?
All right, so Spades is a four player game with two teams. You always have to sit across the table from your team member. It's played with a poker deck, like most trick taking games are. You deal out all 13 cards for every hand, and you keep playing hands until you get to the end score, which is usually 500 points. And some of the specifics that people play by vary of like how many points you get for that or whatever. But like the basics of it is you and your partner bid how many tricks you think you can take. You can't talk about what you have in your hand. You just you go around counterclockwise from the dealer and say, I think I can take three tricks. I can take three tricks. Say everybody bids three. That means that you and your partner each have to collectively get six. And then it follows very much the formula of what you're talking about. Spades are the trump suit. You can't play that unless you don't have any of the lead suit, have to follow suit, and then high card wins. Spades trumps the high card, so the high spade will win over whatever else. And then you get 10 points for every trick that you bid. If you're playing with sandbags, once you get 10 sandbags, you lose 100 points.
Sandbags being you took more tricks than you said you were going to take.
That's right. And then there's usually a component where you can bid nil, which is the idea that I'm going to go through this hand without taking any tricks, which is interesting. I think you see a lot of some sort of variant of this in trick-taking games, where you're usually going to get more points or to win a hand, but there's this inverse strategy where it just flips the whole game around. So if I'm your partner and I bid nil, you're going to make sure I don't take any tricks, and both members of the other team are going to try their best to try to get me to take a trick. And that's really much the game.
Yeah, very equivalent to shooting the moon and hearts. Yep. Or...
So if you and I bid three tricks apiece, mm-hmm. so we need to get six between us.
Yep.
I can get five and you can get one
yep.
as long as we get six between us. What happens if we get less than six?
Then you don't get any points. Zero points.
So you are incentivized to bid as many as you can for certain take. Mm-hmm. And that's where the whole sandbags things comes in, where I know that I can take four, but I'm only going to bid three because then I know I'll take those three and I'll get an extra one. But if I get too many extra ones, that's a penalty as well.
Yeah, if you play without the sandbag rule, it becomes a very conservative game, especially if you're ahead. Because, you know, you can be late in the game. Maybe you're up by 200 points. Well, I'm just going to bid. I can easily take four, but I'm just going to bid two because the other team's not going to catch up. So that sandbag rule means that you have to take every bid really seriously because you never want to be off. You're going to not get anything if you lose there. And if you get too many extras, you're going to lose a bunch of points too.
So why do you like this game?
Well, I think some of it's just sentiment, you know, because I grew up playing this game. Everyone in my extended family played this game. My whole extended family, my mom's side, would get together, I don't know, five or six times a year. And every time we got together, there was a game of spades going on. So I grew up playing it. I love it. Every time I sit down and I play a game of spades, I'm reliving all of those times. And that's really my approach to games in general. You know, I have a handful of games that I really enjoy. And while I'm open to playing new games and doing new things, there's nothing like a classic game that I've gotten to know. because I'm bringing all of that previous goodwill into the game with me.
We did mention that you were part of the Cult of the Old on our Cult of the New episode.
Yeah.
Which is nothing wrong with that.
Sure.
But that is one of the reasons why. Kitty, what is your favorite classic trick-taking game? You can't use spades and you can't use euchre because I'm going to use euchre.
Well, it sticks me with hearts is the one that I've played. But I've heard that having hearts as your game makes you like a liar and a cheat.
Hearts is a game of thieves.
I love hearts. There it is.
Hearts is fun. That's actually the one I grew up playing. But once I learned spades, I think spades kind of took over because I think there's more nuance there. Hearts is not a team game. No. You play just on your own.
But you still play four players, usually.
You have to have four players.
I think you can play with a blind hand.
You can play with a dead hand. Yeah,
Describe hearts.
So hearts is, I haven't played in so long. Very similar to spades. You play four players. A suit is led, but with spades, you want the spades. With hearts, you don't want the hearts. Any heart in your hand is a negative. And shooting the moon is when you try to get all the hearts. Yep. There's also, is it the Queen of Spades?
Queen of Spades counts as it's 13 points.
It's 13 points.
Yeah, so each heart is a point. But it's not about whether or not it's in your hand at the beginning. It's whether or not it's in the trick that you take. Right.
So you're trying to get rid to not have hearts in your tricks that you take.
Yep. So you want to, like, and it's kind of a reverse trick taking game mm-hmm. where you want to get rid of all of these cards. You don't want to have any. And this one, hearts ends when you hit a certain score, right? And then the lowest score wins.
I don't remember exactly.
I believe so.
Yep.
It's like golf.
Yep. And when I play hearts, and I haven't played since college, but I used to be, I was always like, I want to get all the hearts. I want to collect everything. It's worth the risk because it's so cool when it happens.
It's fun.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you can pull it off, it's, you know, maybe you play 20 games of hearts. You can lose 19 times, but if you win once shooting the moon, it's totally worth it.
Totally worth it. So my game is Euchre. Euchre is a very Midwestern mm-hmm. game, spelled Euchre. Now,
Don't ask why.
I thought there was a K in there.
Nope. It is, as far as I know, I've never met anyone
outside Midwest ticket. I know. Saying that.
I've never met anyone outside of the Midwest who knows of the game or has played it. They might have heard of it. But the way Euchre plays is you only use the cards from 9 to ace. Mm-hmm. And you deal out all the cards except for, just again, four players. You deal out all the cards but four. So you have three blind and you flip up the top one and you go around the table and they decide whether or not the suit of the card that was flipped up should be trump or not. And you can say pass or pick it up, and the dealer would pick it up and they would put another card face down. So the dealer has a trump card automatically if that was ordered up. If your partner orders it up, then you have more trump between you. But if one of your opponents orders it up, you have a trump and they are just going to work around it. So they might order up a low 9 or 10. If it goes all the way around, the dealer gets the chance to pick it up. And if they don't, they flip it down. And then around again, everyone gets to call trump or had chance to call trump if they want to. And if they can't call trump of the card they just flipped down. But what they're trying to say is, I'm going to call trump of something where I can take three or more tricks. I think it's three because mm-hmm. there's five total tricks in the game. If it passes all the way around to the dealer again, traditional rules are the deal just passes, but I always play with screw the dealer. So if it makes it to the dealer the second time, the dealer has to choose because I think it's more fun that way. And then the game proceeds with the person to the left of the dealer leads and high card wins, takes the trick. You can't play trump until trump is broken, being you couldn't follow suit. So then you can play trump to take the trick. And then there's some fancy, I'll say fancy because there's no real good reason for it. But in Euchre, when you're trump, the jack is the highest card. The jack of the opposite suit of the same color is the second highest. And then it goes ace, king, mm-hmm. and down. Those are left bowers and right bowers. And I still don't know which one's which, but I just know it's jack suited, jack other suit. And then
my family always called the big bower and the little bower.
Big bower, little bower is a better way to go with it. But this is a game you play, you use the fives to score. So the first team that scores 10 points wins. You get a point for taking three tricks. You get 2 points if you take all of the tricks. You get You lose 2 points. No, you never lose points. If you say that you are going to pick up the tricks, but you don't, your team doesn't, then the other team gets 2 points. And you can also go alone, so your partner doesn't help you. And if you take everything, you get 4 points there. I love this game. It's a game you can drink and smack talk.
Yeah, which I think is why it's so popular in the Midwest. I think particular because you don't need a piece of paper to keep score.
Yeah.
Since you're not using any of the low cards, you can take a 4 and a 6, put them down, and by uncovering some of the pips, yeah. Then by the time you've got them both turned over and completely revealed, you know you've gotten to 10 points. Yep.
And I love the fact that you have the 4, 6 people and you mm-hmm. have the double five people.
Yeah.
So I've always used double fives, but every once in a while I come across someone who uses 4s and 6s. And I'm like, all right, that's fine too. I've never seen a 3-7.
I guess that's just crazy.
Who would do that?
It's garbage.
Garbage, I say. So all of these trick-taking games, though, and there's a bunch more too. The Midwest seems to have a whole lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
Very regional. And they're all just kind of variations off this idea of you follow suit, and there's usually some kind of trump suit.
So I'm going to challenge that. I have a controversial opinion on this.
All right.
I think that war is a trick-taking game. I would say that war is the fundamental trick-taking, because it is the only thing that happened. There's no strategy.
No.
That happens is you take tricks, and there's no concept of trump. There's not like rounds or keeping scores, right? It's just going through it.
Yeah.
I think the only thing
there is a tie consequence.
Yeah, there's a tie consequence. Yeah. I think the only thing that really matters, what makes a game a trick-taking game, is that cards come together and then someone wins that conflict.
Usually the high number. I can't think of a trick-taking game.
Well, there's the trump thing.
Right? Yeah.
Well, but still it's the highest number of trump.
Well, no, we just played moons.
Well,
and again, so it's usually there's yeah.
Moons is a we're going to talk about moons and yet outside of
the outside of the classics.
Outside of the classics. Yes. We're discussing the classics right now.
Well, yes. I actually
and
so
I'm putting the whist and bridge thrown in there too is classic.
I haven't played either of those, and I'd like to pick them up at some point because I enjoy trick-taking games so much. I think being part of the cult of the old, I got to go real old.
Yeah,
I got to go back there because if older is better, let's go ancient.
Yeah, yeah. Let's bring back bridge.
We should bring back whist. Yeah. Jane Austen would love it.
I think alluding to what you were just describing in Moons, which we'll catch up to, is there's this dynamic in spades and in a lot of other trick-taking games where when you can't take the trick, if you can throw down like the lowest kind of most useless
trash card,
you kind of feel good about it. Like, oh yeah, I got rid of that two of diamonds that I'll never use. And in spades, at least, there's a lot of strategy of, well, which suit do you throw off?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so that's another commonality in trick-taking games is short suiting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Getting rid of a suit so that you have options when that suit is led, because otherwise you have to follow suit and it takes away some control. If you don't have that suit, you can decide, do I throw off a suit that I'm not going to use? Do I trump the suit or trump the trick that's going on? Maybe my partner already has it, but I'm going to get rid of this other suit that is relatively not great in my hand right now.
Right.
So those are interesting concepts. And I agree with you. I think war is a trick-taking game. In fact, so from Board Game Geek, Terrence, you're getting mentioned a lot in this podcast. He mentions a game which I'm not sure is a trick-taking game, but it's kind of an opposite. But he reads, one card game I've played a couple times is called Pairs. It's kind of a press-your-luck opposite. What you're doing is, so this is how Pairs plays. Pairs is a simple press-your-luck game. Players take turns taking cards, trying not to get a pair. If you get a pair, you score points, and points are bad. You can also choose to fold instead of taking a card, and then score the lowest card in play. Folding gets you some points, but catching a pair could get you even more. Pairs don't have a winner, just a loser. The first player to reach a target score loses, and the target score depends on the number of players. For example, a 4-player game, the loser loses at 16 points.
What a negative game.
It is so negative.
I would love it.
I was going to say, there is no winner, only a loser.
Only a loser. That could be an entire show topic by itself. It's like, nope, we just play until someone loses. Everyone else is the winner.
Yeah.
Which maybe that's a good way to go about it. But this is the same kind of concept where you're trying not to take a trick,
mm-hmm.
right? You're trying to like, I'm risking it. How far can I go without taking a trick? But it's kind of in the same line of war where Like, and I agree with you. I think War is absolutely a trick-taking game. There's, going back to the question of randomness, War is 100% random trick-taking game because you don't really have any control over what's being flipped up.
Right. The deck is shuffled. That's right. Where the randomness comes from. And then it just unfolds.
Right.
It's really a game of shuffle this deck and then see who won.
Yeah.
It's already determined.
Yep.
Is Egyptian Rat Race a trick-taking game?
Describe the rules.
So all the cards are dealt. You place a card in the middle until a face card comes up. If you play an ace, the person who plays next has 4 chances to turn up a face card. If not, you take all the cards from the middle.
I would say based on that one line alone, sure.
And
I don't feel like it's a trick-taking game.
It's sort of an edge case because I do think...
You're collecting cards.
If War is one, it feels very similar to War.
Well, but War is your... So to me, a trick is cards facing off, and then whoever wins gets those cards. You won that trick. That's not what's happening in this game, an Egyptian Rat Race. It's you, like, at some point you can jump in and grab the cards, right? But that's not really a trick.
Well, it's because it's based on what comes out. It is like a pot that is built.
Yeah.
But I think it's the only game that's close, but I think
the line is somewhere between Egyptian Rat Race and War. Yeah.
Well, let's go to games that are actual trick-taking games, but are now have a little bit of a modern twist to it. And we have two that we've played recently. Both of them are very clearly trick-taking games, mm-hmm. and they both add additional elements to the trick-taking aspect to make it a little bit more interesting. The one that's recently came out, actually the one that sort of came up with the idea for this show, is Moons. We talked about Moons a few episodes ago. It jumped up on the hotness list on Board Game Geek. And it's like, oh, it's a trick-taking game. So let's talk about that one first. We just played that today. Mm-hmm. Moons, if you're not aware, is it's literally moons. planets in our solar system become the suits. So there's 4 suits.
Jupiter, Uranus, Neptune, and Saturn.
Saturn. So those 4 suits. And then each one of those suits has a number of moons that go along with it. There are 17 moons tokens for each planet. And those moon tokens they're just
sitting in a pot in the middle of the table.
Right. When you lead for your particular moon, and I'll use colors because it's easier. There's yellow, blue, brown, and
grayish.
Yeah.
I would call it orange.
Orange.
I'm going to throw out right now. I felt like the colors sometimes weren't distinct enough.
Yeah, they were pretty close. But whatever the case, we put the colors range from 1 to 14. Mm-hmm. The cards within the colors range from 1 to 14. If I play a 14, Kitty has to follow suit. Spencer has to follow suit. And the highest card wins. But if I played a 14, I'm always going to win because Moons doesn't have a trump. Instead, what Moons has is if you can't follow suit, you can play offsuit, obviously, and the lowest offsuit card also gets a benefit from that trick. So in Moons, if I take the trick, I can choose one of the 4 moons out on the table in relation to as long as it matches a card that's in my tableau. At the very beginning of the game, you're going to pick 3 cards to be in your tableau. So if I take a trick, I can take one of those. If I don't take the trick, but I play the lowest offsuit, I get a moon of the type of that card. So you can get up to 2 moons per trick, essentially. Mm-hmm. At the very end of the round, whoever has the most tricks can take another moon that matches something in their tableau. If you didn't take any tricks at all, you can take any moon you want. And then the moons at the very end of the game, you keep playing until you run out of moons or until everybody's been the dealer once. The moons at the end of the game combine together to be your score. And that's kind of set collection score. So what Moons does is it takes this concept of tricks, removes trump, but adds this element of low cards can still be valuable. We were just talking about normally it's the low card are really bad. But in this game, having some low cards could be good as long as you can play them at the right time. And then the scoring isn't about how many tricks you take overall. It's about how many moons you can collect and how you can score those sets at the end of the game.
Yeah, I think Moons is, at least in my experience, kind of unique as well. Obviously, I do think this idea of like a modern tabletop game built on top of trick taking is it's a small space. It hasn't been explored a lot. And what I like that Moons has done is they've abstracted a layer on top of that, yep. right? A lot like, Niet, which we'll get to, I think does a lot of playing with the nature of a trick-taking game and how that works. Moons takes this idea of like, okay, yeah, we mess around with what it means to how you take tricks a little bit. But then winning the trick is just the first step.
Right.
Now there's this sort of meta game that you're playing with the tokens, and that adds on top of it. So there's really two different layers of the game there. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. And then, Kitty, you want to describe the asteroid cards because you had a ton of them in our last game.
I did have a ton of them. So the asteroid cards are, they're like no suit, but you get a mini asteroid card when you play the large size asteroid card. And everyone starts with two of the mini cards, and they can give you special scoring conditions. They can allow you to trade cards from your hand to anyone's tableau. They can allow you to trade tokens one for one with another player. And there's a card where you can get
shield yourself.
Yeah, it's a shield, the don't mess with me.
Yep. You might say these cards introduce an element of randomness into the game.
They do.
Definitely.
Depending on your definition.
So the scorecards don't have to be revealed. The mini asteroid cards are played before you play your larger moon card in a turn.
Yep. So it adds another element of, kind of strategicness to it, and luck, because the mini asteroid cards can be just give you different ways of scoring your token at the end of the game, or it can be like, okay, I can screw over Kitty. Actually, Spencer, you did more of this. By taking away moons from her, that would give her completed sets, but they gave you completed sets.
Yeah.
So it was more of a way of adding some more player interaction in there.
And neither of us won because of it.
No. I dragged you down to my level.
Yeah. Well, all three of us lost that game. Sydney.
I did play an asteroid heavy strategy and it did not pay off.
Yeah. Well, and that's the interesting thing about this game too. So we mentioned the asteroid cards. There's big asteroid cards and little ones. The little ones are the things that you can play to do stuff. The big ones are just played to get little asteroid cards, but you can use them in place of your card that you're going to play for that trick, or you can use it with a card that you're going to play for that trick.
So that's where I got tripped up a little bit in my sort of the execution of a few of my hands. And I think the asteroid cards are actually probably really vital, the big asteroid cards, to properly playing out your hand. Because managing to make sure that you get those low card moons as well as winning the tricks is really the big thing here, right? You can't get a lot of moons unless you're winning both the low and the high. When you're not taking the trick, you want to be the low one as much as possible. And I think the asteroid card, so I kept forgetting that if I had the suit that was lead, I could play an asteroid card instead.
Yep.
Because I kept it, the only thing that's constant is you have to follow suit. So I sort of automatically go, that's the color. I got to put this down here. I don't have a choice in the matter. I forget it. In some ways, it's almost like an inverse trump.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't win the hand for you, but you can do it to not follow suit when you would normally have to.
And you want to save your suit. Yeah. Save your 13 because the 14 was just played and you have the 13, so I can put the asteroid out there.
Or save your one. Yeah.
Yep. So this one is interesting. Like I say, it adds the set building scoring to it. And it's also a short game. Mm-hmm. Like you're never going to play more than the number of rounds equal to the number of players.
I don't think you could get more than four rounds.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I think the game actually plays up to six.
Made it into the fourth round.
Yeah.
So it does play to six. If you did play to six, I don't think the fifth and sixth person would ever have a chance to deal.
And in that case, it might be to your advantage to put a high card in your tableau to start, because that's how it determines where the first player is. Yep.
But there's also maybe you don't want to lead. I made the mistake of leading in the first and taking that trick when if I had not done that, I would have ended up no tricks, but I would have had enough low cards where I would have been able to pick a moon at the end.
But you can't throw off those 14s like you can. I guess you can throw them off suit.
Yes, you'd have to throw them off suit.
But I'm not sure what the strategy is. I guess if it's the only one played, it is still technically the lowest off suit.
Yep. But what it really does is it does add this element of, I want to try it again. I want to try a different strategy. It gives the chance for strategy, but it's still a trick-taking game in the end, because when I look at it, when I looked at my cards, I'm like, okay, this is not going to be a good hand. I have all cards between like 4 and 8, 4 and 10, and those middle cards are always going to be bad usually. So I'm like, all right, this is just going to be a throwaway hand. I'll see what I can salvage from it. Now, Niet, on the other hand, adds a different level to this. Now, what Niet does is at the beginning of the game, before you even start playing, you have all your cards, and it's the same thing. You have four suits. There's a trump. You sometimes high card takes it, must follow suit. But Niet has a board that you're going to add block tokens to. So you're going around the table and everyone's going to block something out at these different levels of the board. So the first level is the first player, so that you can play up to five players with Niet. And the first player, you know, the last person blocked out becomes the first player. So there's pictures of each player, and Niet has these, all these Russian cute animals. The second one is whether or not you discard any cards from your hand before you start. So this allows you to kind of like short suit yourself. The next line is trump. So there's four different trumps. You have flags, stars, sickles, and hammers. And depending on which one's remaining, the last one that's not blocked out, that will become trump. And then you have this concept of super trump, which is a new concept for Niet as far as trump's concerned, where the one is the super trump. Like, it can trump trump.
It's like the jacks.
It's kind of like the big Euchre, dollar. Yeah.
Or the, sometimes you'll play with the jokers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And sometimes it exists, but there's a way of, like, if you can, the Niet space of it is, there is no super trump. And then the most interesting one, especially when you're bidding, is the number of points per trick. Because there's five spaces here. 1, 2, 3, 4, or -2. So if you have a really bad hand, and you want to make sure that I'm not going to take any tricks, and I want everyone else to get negative points, I can try to manipulate to make all of the tricks negative points.
Because if I remember right, you do this in order. So you determine who the first player is.
No. You can put them anywhere.
Anywhere on the board.
Anywhere on the board, yep.
Yeah. I remember that one was often kind of the last one, though, because, you know, oh, I've been forced to be the first player. I don't have any good cards. I don't have any of this trump. And then I'm going to spend the rest of my tokens to make sure -2 is the points, or at least they're only worth 1 point.
Yeah. Well, I think there's one more element to this, and that's the first player then gets to choose a partner.
Yes.
So, and you don't really discuss it ahead of time. You're just basically looking on based on what that person did as to whether or not you think you would make a good partner with them.
So I got to say now, this is probably the best game you've ever made me play.
Okay.
I really, really liked this game. It combines everything that I like in a tabletop game. It's sort of brought together and brought together with a sort of an elegance to it here. So it's a trick-taking game, yep. Right? And it's a trick-taking game with a lot of dynamics going on, so it's not always the same. Every hand's a little bit different, but the rules are simple enough that you can follow them. It's a series of really simple rules, but when you combine those, it becomes a really complex situation. That's one of my favorite things in games, because it's easy to learn, but a really deep space to explore. And it has a sort of simple aesthetic to it. It's got this Soviet Revolution sort of political thing going on that's, on the surface level, completely irrelevant to the mechanics of the game, but perfectly fits the dynamic, because yep. Everyone's trying to read each other and sort of playing off like they know what's going on, and no one really knows what the rules are until they're settled, and then you have to see who comes out on top. So it's got this sort of political intrigue, up is down, left is right kind of thing going on.
And you never really know until the hand starts.
You never really know until the hand yep. starts.
And even then, you could have the most amazing hand before the bidding starts. And then at the end, you're just like, oh, how am I going to play this?
And right. Now I have a terrible hand.
Right, yep. Right. Yeah. And then on top of all that, the artwork's really cool.
Yeah.
Like when you look at the cards, they feel really cool. Like,
yep.
I don't know. I think
yeah, and there's special
long
Soviet art
yep.
aesthetic is always just kind of cool to look at.
Yeah. Like, no, I really like this game. And we played it several times one night, and we haven't pulled it out since.
I know. We have to play it again.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is a game where you can pretty much get anyone to play, and the bidding is really fun because everyone just goes around. You have your own little tokens that match your character, and you just block out something.
I believe you can play them face up or face down. I think the rules say face down, but we were playing them face up sometimes, so you could kind of
see who was bidding.
Remember
where.
Who had what.
Yep.
And I kind of like that little house rule that we had.
Yep. So you can kind of see it's like, okay, you didn't want blue and red, and I have a lot of blue and red, so you're not going to be a good partner if
Well, I don't know. If you have opposite suits, that can be great too. Yeah, depends.
I'd say that's another like element of the elegance of the game, right? Because there's something about, well, you better be paying attention or you're not going to remember who put this here or whatever. But I think this is sort of a principle that you have, right? That any information that's been revealed should always just be there.
I don't think that memory, unless the game is specifically meant to be a memory game, I don't like that if one person has a better memory than another person, they have an advantage in the game. Because it's more almost a metagame aspect. Mm-hmm. Let the strategy play it out, not that I can remember that you blocked out X, Y, and Z, and it would be easy enough to be able to track that.
Yeah, so I think that memory aspect kind of fits the aesthetic of the game, which might be by the rules that the tokens go face down. But the fact that I don't think it's a coincidence that you can play them face up, that they're labeled that way. It's cool.
Yeah. And I like the idea that the partners change every round too. So you're always playing for your own points, but you want to get a partner that's allowing you to get as many points as you can. But at a certain point, you can't choose the ideal partner if that partner would win if you chose them.
Well, you might even pick that partner just to drag them down.
Yep.
You're right? Associated with my garbage hand.
You can maybe, sacrifice yourself, take a dive on the hand just to keep the game alive.
Yep. So I want to get Steve's feedback here. Like, this is... We're ending on a high note. I think Niet is a really good trick-taking game. But Steve says, I've got to say that these games are one of the things I think about for non-gamers. That, to me, is different than someone who may potentially try board games out. This is for the people I know who don't want more and something classic will work for them. I played Hearts and Euchre a lot when I was young and with my mother and sisters. And when I got a bit older, I learned Spades and enjoyed that as well with friends. But ultimately, these games fall flat for me. I want something more out of a game, and these just never seem to quite deliver. I've played modern games, Red 7, Niet, both come to mind here. And while clever and they add things, I wasn't compelled to keep playing them. I enjoy Love Letter much more, and it's a simpler game in the end that I will come back to over both of them. And he goes on, it's probably just him. But I think it is a valid comment to say people who like deeper board game experiences, maybe the pieces, the components, more strategy to it. These ones, trick-taking games in general, tend to have they have strategy to them, but they don't have a lot of ways of getting to that strategy, right? I mean, your bidding strategy is important. Being able to read your partner and read your opponents is important. But ultimately, the trick is taking tricks or not taking tricks. And that's really where you can go. What board games do typically is give you more branches that you can go down to achieve your goal. So is that like the primary difference? Because I would say, Niet, I could teach my mom and she would be like, oh yeah, let's play this game. I totally understand it. I'm not afraid of this. I understand adding a little bit of a board element to it. But if I was to pull out some heavier game, like Fields of Green, it's not a complicated game, but it is way more complicated than a typical Niet or Moons or something like that.
Especially because so many people are familiar with at least one trick-taking game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a basis of knowledge. You can say, this is like Hearts, or this is like Spades, or this is, we're going to change some of the rules, but it's at least enough like that that it's not hard to teach.
I think you made a light bulb pop up in my head. You have something there because, like Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
When people think board games, they think Monopoly. And when you think Monopoly, you think long and tedious normally. So, sure, I'm not really into board games because the only board game I know is Monopoly. But if I say, let's play a card game, like a trick-taking game, oh, yeah, I've played trick-taking games. It almost always involves talking with friends and drinking at the same time. And in the 80s, smoking, of course, as well. but now, like if you say, oh, let's play this trick-taking game, they have something to associate it to that goes back to being fun. Board games, like these gateway games, these are the type of games we want to be able to say, oh, it's like this other thing that you like to do. And then you can build on top of that.
Like Santorini. It's like complicated tic-tac-toe.
Yeah.
It's
like, oh, you've played Connect Four. It's just like that, but in 3D.
Right? Yeah.
And, Steve's comment here of basically saying, these trick-taking games aren't his thing and he's familiar with them. I totally get that. It makes sense. It is a different kind of experience. And while I think it's great that so many people are familiar with trick-taking games. You've got that as sort of a gateway or a segue. I think that's part of why there aren't that many, you know, games like Niet and Moons, because when you get into more of the gamer board gaming community, I think people think a deck of cards and they think bros playing poker.
Yeah.
And they're like, that's not me. I don't want to do that kind of thing. Right. Which is kind of like if you went up to a bunch of bros playing poker and you said, hey, you want to play Race for the Galaxy? And they'd be like, ah, that's not me, bro. Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's cool that there's games that are kind of bridging the gap there.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I would say, I think we would all recommend Niet to any board gamer. I would recommend Niet to. There's enough to this game where I would still potentially, if you're going to classify something as a filler game, it could be this because it does play fast, but there's enough depth there and the box is nice and portable. It's a solid game. Moons, I'm still on the fence about.
It's a little simple.
Yeah. I'm not sure if the set collection makes it different enough to make it better than some of the more classic ones I've played.
I think it adds a layer of complexity to it. It kind of, that irks me a little bit just on a personal level, because as we kind of saw at the end of our game there, it's hard to realize who's winning. Right. Yep. And there's the secret element of you can have special cards that change the way it's scored, which, you know, yeah, it increases the complexity of the game. But to me, complexity in and of itself isn't always good.
Right.
I also feel like my organizational skills were a detriment because I like to have my sets set out where everyone can see them. And Chris had this like just pile of tokens. And I know he says that he wasn't trying to do it on purpose, but it was really hard to see what he had. And I had mine all lined up. And at some point, I just like scrambled mine.
But I think that
Chris is a good cheater, and that's fine.
I
you should be proud of how good you are at cheating.
It was not my intent to make it difficult to read the tokens. But I think that it does just go back to Spencer's point of it's really hard to tell who's going to win.
Because
even if you see all the tokens out there, you can only really count what's on the board. And you never know what those secret cards are going to do.
It's kind of reminiscent of a point salad game like that. Not as severe, right? Yeah. But I guess to that point, if you really like point salad, you really like point salad games and you kind of like trick taking games or whatever, this kind of, it's a lightweight combination.
I will say Moons is probably kind of a point salad-y trick taking game.
Yeah.
Because you're collecting sets at the end and you have like multiple different ways of putting those sets together, which is giving you these different bowls of points at the end. So
still mad.
I know.
That's weird.
You won last week.
I know. We were using the wrong scoring, though. Who knows if I actually won?
Well, I think we did a pretty decent job on trick-taking games. Spencer, thanks for helping us out.
You're welcome, I guess.
So, I mean, it was nice having your negativity turned around to a positivity towards trick-taking games.
You positive about that?
No, not really. All right, Kitty.
So thank you for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review. Email us with comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. Visit our site, tabletopgametalk.com, to learn more about becoming part of the conversation. Finally, a huge thank to our patrons, Emil Jiljam, Shane Poole, George, Adam Harrison, Tom Bly, Jason Strong, Lucas Hartsoe, Michael Ohl, Josh Arntz, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean Kelly, Joseph Lee, John Merkel, Daniel Shepard, C. Marie, Rudy Liu, Benjamin Hamowitz, Jerry Huang, Alex Brown, Mike Smith, and Terrence Miltner.
Well, that's a lot of supporters.
If you'd like to support us via Patreon and be auto-entered into all of our giveaways, you can find out more at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. Until next week, when we talk about traveling with games. Keep playing games and having fun.
Good night. Yeah, when Josh isn't here, that's not a long list.
I did even worse than Josh.
You did a little bit.